I'm Martin Yelling, he's Tom Williams, and this is Marathon Talk. It's Wednesday, the 15th of June, 2011, and this is episode 75 of Marathon Talk. On this week's show, we've got a great interview with Brit Matt Dixon. He's the guy who helped Ryan Hall to his 204 marathon in Boston earlier in the year. It's a little quiet on the news front, but we do have Listeners Marathons, Rate Your Run, Rant and Rave, and Winner of the Week, plus, of course, the legend, the man, everyone's hero, Tony Audenshaw, in Tony's Trials. But Tom, what have you been doing?
Well, I've been doing a few things. In fact, I forgot to put on the show notes, but I did have a good old crack at my local park run on Saturday. And it was interesting. It got me thinking back to the Tim Noakes interview and the central governor stuff. And Tim said how a little period of training can increase fitness and increase performance much more than it should do, just purely due to training. And that was part of his thoughts behind the central governor thing and how some intense work actually allows your central governor to work harder. And it was interesting because I absolutely smashed myself round Leeds Park Run, and I wasn't feeling particularly tired. I was feeling quite good, and I was really, really, really breathing hard. My heart rate was really, really up there, like normal and low 170s by the end. And I did 20 minutes and 4 seconds, which is a couple of minutes off my PB. And I don't think I've ever gone over 20. Well, not ever. I don't think it's a long time since I've gone over 20 minutes when I've tried hard. And I thought, you know what? I can't have lost fitness. My heart and lungs can't be any weaker than they were a little while ago.
Yeah, but you have gained a few. You have gained a few things. You may not have lost anything, but you sure have gained a few things.
Well, I've certainly gained a few pounds, that's for sure. But it's interesting, I think. And we're running again this Saturday, and I wouldn't mind betting that even with a week of not really running, I've not really run at all much this week, I would imagine I'll go quite a bit faster for the similar effort. And it's interesting because it just made me think about that whole central governor thing and how performance is so much more than just pure fitness and training. Anyway, that was interesting. I was also on Monday in London with Sir Ranulph Fiennes, Dave Bedford and Noel Thatcher.
Wow.
I know, quite a group. We did put a caption competition photo on the Marathon Talk Facebook page. If you want to have a look at those three fine examples posing for the camera, have a look on there, stick a caption on there. You had some great comments. But it was good. It was the launch of the Standard Chartered Great City Run, which Noel's doing. He's an ambassador for the Vision Charity, as is Sir Ranulph Fiennes. And that run raises money for the Vision Charity, which helps to treat preventable blindness. So it's a great charity. It's a great event. We'll be more about that in the future because I think we're going to cover it a little bit. Might look for a pacer for Noel or a guide for Noel. So if you think you can run under 16 minutes for 5K, get your thinking cap on, and more about that in future shows.
Now, did you also pop down to the guys at Toyota?
Yeah, we had quite a day on Monday, in fact, actually, because in the morning we were with the Standard Chartered lot and these guys. And then the afternoon, we nipped over to Toyota in Epsom to speak to a Marathon Talk listener, John Micklefield, and his friends there at Toyota who had got together and run for Japan. Then they raised a couple of grand through an event they did a few months ago. And Toyota have matched that and given us another 2,200 quid, which I think in total, I've not actually looked this morning, but I think it takes the Run for Japan total over £35,000, well over £35,000, wow. I think, close to £40,000 raised, which is just absolutely amazing. All that money's gone to the British Red Cross, and well done to the guys at Toyota and John Micklefield. And the great thing that Noel and I both thought, we went for a run with them around the Derby race course, we had lunch with them. It was really great because they were a really nice bunch of people who had done it purely to do something cool, to do something nice and give something back. And it was great. And it certainly wasn't like just a big corporation saying, and here's some money and tick this box and so on. It really was a great bunch of people doing something fantastic. So that was brilliant. And finally, I have been working on a load of new park run events, but particularly one in Barrow-in-Furness. Now, ooh, we've got funding for the one in Barrow-in-Furness, most of the funding. We've got permission to use the park. I think it's going to be a great event, but we need volunteers to help out and organise that. Now, I'm going to take a trip up to Cumbria in the near future, hopefully, and put on an evening about park run and what it can do and so on. But if you think you can help out with a park run event in Barrow-in-Furness, then drop me an email at tom@parkrun.com and we can get the balls properly rolling. What have you been up to? You've been doing some pretty cool things.
Well, I did a super cool thing recently. I was lucky enough to chat to Mo Farah for the show. I emailed to see if we could get an interview with Mo after his super 26:46 10K run, and he agreed to it. I've met him before a few times, actually. Liz knows him reasonably well through running and him growing up. So it was great that he gave us some time to be interviewed on the show. And he was a really super gracious, fun guy. Everything that you see on the TV when he's kind of running down the home straight with a big smile on his face, he's really like that. So it was brilliant. And we're going to be bringing you the interview with Mo Farah next week.
We must apologise to the listeners for not giving you guys the opportunity to ask questions. It actually happened really, really quickly, didn't it? We went from not having the interview to having the interview.
Yeah.
And doing it in a kind of a split second, as it were. And we do like to try and do that, but sometimes these things just happen and you have to kind of seize the moment, and we didn't quite have the chance, but I'm sure you'll love it. And we might
Seize the moment. Look at you. we really did seize the moment.
And we'll have to leave you guessing as to what his magic mile time was.
Oh, yeah. The other thing I've been doing is building tiny sheds. It was my daughter's second birthday just recently, and we got her one of those little tiny kind of playhouses. So I spent some time putting that together, which of course was...
You got it for you, really.
You know, super fun. I've lost count of the number of times that I stood up in it and cracked my back on the door frame trying to walk out. I'm obviously too tall. You'd be okay. I've been riding my mountain bike as well. Because I'm not doing as much running because of that pesky knee, I've been riding my mountain bike.
And gave yourself a 0.0 on Rate Your Run, I noticed.
Yeah, I know. Just a shocker. I did have to walk home from a run. I did two runs this week. One of them was my little fitness run, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. The other one was a run I thought I'd try and do 50 minutes, but I got to 40 and had to walk home.
Oh,
just got, I know, I've just got this aggravating little knee niggle, which I've got to get. Got to get sorted out. But I have started doing a little fitness run, and it's kind of my, you know, summer fitness campaign, where I've decided what I want to do is build on the press ups, and instead of doing just press ups, I'm doing some sit ups and some conditioning work, and I'm doing it all naturally. So I've found this big heavy log I'm going to lift, and I'm going to the beach and trying to do some pull ups. I did 3 pull ups last week, which was hideous.
Very good.
Yeah, and so it's a very stop start run. I run a little bit, I do a bit on the, you know, a few exercises on the grass, run a bit more, do something else. Takes about 45 minutes. So there we are. I'm going all green fitness.
Mate, we passed through a massive landmark on Sunday, and it all kind of went by with a bit of a whimper, didn't it?
We did. Marathon Talk has reached 500,000. That's 500,000 downloads.
Amazing. Ever since we started in January 10, I think that's 500,000 downloads to something like 137 countries. You know, for us, that's super exciting. I don't think we'd quite imagine that we could have done that right at the beginning. It keeps going stronger and stronger. And we've got something to, in a way of saying thanks, we kind of thought we'd offer a few prizes.
Yeah, some T-shirts, actually. The way we thought we'd do that is the first 3 people to go to this week's show notes and post in the comments section 500,000 downloads and answer the following question. What was Matt Dixon's magic mile time? So that's this week's show notes, which is episode 75, 500,000 downloads in the comments box. And what was Matt Dixon's magic mile time? The first 3 people to do that will win a Marathon Talk 26.2 T-shirt. And we'll deliver it free anywhere in the world to those first 3 people to get that question right in the comments box.
In fact, if you pay for my plane ticket, I'll deliver it free anywhere in the world. Now, moving on, Alex Flynn. We interviewed Alex Flynn, obviously, last week. Only Parkinson's sufferer ever to complete the Marathon des Sables. And he set off on Friday on a phenomenal challenge to run 1,800 miles in 30 days. As of last night, he'd run 268 miles in 5 days. Now, that's not a bad 5-day total, is it? It seems to be going great. He is asking for help and support on his Facebook page and via Twitter and his website and all this kind of stuff, just to keep him motivated. And I have to say thanks to all the Marathon Talkers who took the time to pop over to Alex's Facebook page and wish him good luck. It was great. It was great to go over there myself and see everybody wishing him well. So, you know, keep supporting him, keep pushing him on, and we'll keep following him on Marathon Talk. And we'll put the links as to how you can follow him and do all of that on our show notes.
Now, speaking of other long training epics, what about this one? We've had you had to review a DVD recently for the Epic Camp in New Zealand. Tell us a little bit about what that is.
It was really great. I followed Epic Camp for a long time. And one of the organisers is John Newsome from Iron Man Talk, our good friends over at Iron Man Talk. And Epic Camp was this training camp, this triathlon Ironman training camp, where they just pushed the boundaries of volume, and they'd do these phenomenal 60, 70-hour training weeks in over the course of a week. And a couple of years ago, they did a length of New Zealand where it involved cycling the entire length of New Zealand in 15 days, plus swimming every day, plus biking every day. And I'd really wanted to go on it, actually. We did try and go on it, Hells and I, but we just couldn't really afford to get over to New Zealand in terms of time and money at the time. So, you know, I followed it on their show and all that. Anyway, they did a video of it. A company called Stormy Dog Productions did a really great DVD of Epic Camp. And if you're into kind of extreme endurance training or the stuff that the guys at IM Talk do, then it's great. They sent it over. I really liked it. And I said, oh, we'll give it a bit of a review on the show. So this is what they sent over. Epic Camp Training Camp. So the brainchild of former world Ironman champion Scott Molina, renowned coach and former Ultraman champion Gordo Byrne, and Ironman Talk host, host John Newsome. For over 7 years, the trio designed grueling training camps for professional and top-class age group Ironman triathletes from around the world, but they'd never designed one quite like Epic Camp, the length of New Zealand. Going Long, Going Hard follows 24 elite and age group triathletes as they swim, bike and run from Cape Reinga in the north to the Bluff in the south, and all in 15 days. The documentary takes the viewer on the athlete's 2,250k journey through the stunning New Zealand countryside, and as they move across the terrain, we learn exactly what makes them tick. It's a great film. We'll put the links to how you can get it on the show notes. I think they do free shipping. Don't quote me on this, but I think they do free shipping outside of New Zealand, so you can actually get it without having to pay a fortune for that. And it's really worth watching if you're into extreme stuff.
Maybe we should do kind of, you know, epic marathon talk, marathon camp.
Well, we have talked about it in the past, haven't we? We have talked about, you know, all this free time we have because we're really not that busy. We've thought about, you know, having some more time commitments and doing something else. But yeah, it is bumbling over in the background, isn't it? You know, a kind of an epic, you know, it'd have to be epic. So it'd have to be something like 100-mile week, wouldn't it? So we're a training camp where you did 100 miles running in the week or something. I don't know. No doubt we'll get thousands of emails now and won't be able to say no and we'll get really busy. Anyway.
Speaking of other people who are running
extreme
hundreds
things,
of miles.
Yeah, extreme.
Yeah, speaking of other great things, Donnie Campbell is this Saturday setting off to run the 104 miles.
No, not 104, mate. 184.
Oh, it's 184. He's running 184 miles from Glasgow to Skye.
Yep, amazing. Marathon Talk listener Donnie Campbell, have a great run. Also, Marathon Talk listeners Pete and Martin Scull are running Plymouth to Ilfracombe 17th of June this Friday. 102 miles non-stop. Two great challenges there.
And we'll... Is that the Skull brothers, or are they father and son? Do you know?
They're actually, uncle and... What does that make him? Nephew. Nephew and uncle.
Oh,
Pete.
Oh, okay.
Pete is the nephew. Martin is his uncle. And yeah, they're running 102 miles non-stop. Plymouth to Ilfracombe. Great effort. We'll put links to both those challenges on our show notes.
Now, I'm about to have a slapped wrist, aren't I, for show notes last week for missed listeners' marathons. Three people have written in. We are working on a marathontalk.com solution to listeners' marathons to save us going through your postings and trying to rank them. So I have been told off by
I don't think these were your fault. I think these were nobody's fault, these.
Oh, thanks. Anyway, look, Eleanor Franks, you ran 4:04, 4 hours 4 at Windermere, the Windermere Marathon. Hannah Gilman, you actually ran 3:37 at Stockholm. And John Kay, you were first vet 50, running an incredible 2:51 at the Edinburgh Marathon.
Fantastic. And that's first vet 50 overall. Now, Mark, the Friday Facebook post.
The Friday Facebook post is something we thought we would kick off a while ago, and we started to ask questions and we want opinions on things and listeners' reviews and thoughts on different topics. So we've been doing this Friday Facebook posting, and last Friday was simply amazing. We posted, tell us about the myths, the mistakes, the misconceptions that you had as beginner new runners. We had a really amazing response to that. Thanks to everyone who offered their thoughts. Some common themes, some things that came up quite a lot were running clubs. They're perhaps not quite as scary as you thought they were. That more or harder training is always better. And the mistakes when choosing crazy kit.
As usual, we'll kick the news off with Rate Your Run. This week, 8.1 from 90 ratings, started with Dave Hampton. Dave gave himself 10.0 and he says, I haven't been running much recently, but I set three goals for this week. One, to complete our club's 10K time trial. 2, to come in under an hour, and 3, to get my Rate Your Run on top of the list and get a mention on next week's episode. I achieved 1 and 2, my time, 57.55. Nowhere near my PB, but very happy under the circumstances. 3 is up to you guys. I recently posted that I had my metabolic age measured at an expo, and I came in at 44, 15 years younger than my actual age of 59. That's why I run.
Nice. Simon Lewis, you ran a superb cross country in Wales called Man v Horse, and you gave yourself a Rate Your Run rating of 9.1. You said it's 22 miles of hills, mud, rain, sun, more than 3,000 feet of ascent, horses, and plenty of magnificent countryside. Wales is stunning, you say. Came in at 3:52 and loved it all. And Simon, I remember a bloke from the running club I used to run for, Bedford and County, Hugh Lobb, was the first person to beat the horse in that race.
Yeah, didn't he win a fortune? Because didn't the prize go up by £1,000 every year? And didn't he
win? Yeah, William Hill. That's
17
right,
grand Hill. Or something.
Yeah, they used to sponsor the event, and as the first runner to beat the horse. He was a very, very good runner, mind. I think he had a 2:15 marathon personal best. So, yeah, great.
Yeah, and I think someone won it the year after and only won a grand because he'd won the 17. You'd be well, gutted, wouldn't you?
Yeah, there must have been all dodgy horses that entered that
anyway, year. You've got to love a race with horses in. Anyway, Tim Cook, 10.0, has to be a 10 for running just outside my PB for a very hilly half marathon on the island of Hoy in Orkney. 1:23.58 was good enough for second place, and I haven't done better than third at any race in nearly 20 years. Hoy may be a little bit off the beaten track, but it should be noted that the course record is held by the Dan Robinson of Episode 7 fame. A lovely afternoon for a post-race beer in the sun too.
Liz Joyner, you also gave your weekend run a 10. My first trail race, the Decmont Law 10K. Absolutely brilliant. Lovely local race, well organised. Great, very hilly course, friendly atmosphere. At the finish, there was a drink and a slice of Clouty dumpling. What more could you ask for? I don't know. I really don't know, Liz, because I'm at a loss to what Clouty dumpling is.
Well, it must be good, though. I don't know if it's as good as horses, but it sounds pretty good. Andrew Smith, 1.0, and he says, I am now a proud member of Team GB. That's Team Gingerbread. I've had lots of interesting runs during the last week, pardon the pun. Unfortunately, they've occurred exactly halfway into my 12-mile jog to work each day. What a nice way to start the day by pooing your pants. Lovely. We continue to bring you news of Sammy Wanjiru. He was laid to rest on Saturday, and we've taken this from a Kenyan website, capitalfm.co.ke. Sammy Wanjiru was laid to rest on Saturday with the World Marathon Majors promising to rename the Elite Circuit Trophy after him, cementing his name in marathon running history. Representing the World Marathon Majors, London race director Dave Bedford said, "He is simply the greatest marathon runner of all time. His victory at the Olympics was the signature and the best race ever run. London Marathon will be honoured since he gave us memorable races in 2008 and then won a year later. I came here to represent the World Marathon Majors, and we have sat down and decided to name the trophy after him, and it is only fitting since he won it twice in a row." Wanjiru won the $500,000 jackpot for the first time in the 08-09 season and held on to the trophy when he won last year's Chicago Marathon against Ethiopian rival Tsege Kabidi. Kenyan Olympic Committee chairman and running legend Kip Kaino said, "We have lost a hero, and this should teach our athletes to take care of themselves. It is very sad that this young life has gone, but we shall always remember what he did for his country."
Now, what about the marathons you've been running? Your marathons, this is marathons. It was the Baslow Boot Bash this past weekend. And first for Marathon Talk was Jimmy Smith. Jimmy finished in 5 hours and 8 minutes. It was a beautiful, undulating off-road course through the Peak District with well over 3,000 feet of ascent. Jimmy hoped to get under 5 hours, but a bad navigation on this point-to-point race between 8 checkpoints slowed him down. He ended up covering over 28 miles on what should have been a marathon distance. Come on, Jimmy, swat up with the old compass and map.
Dear, oh dear. It was also the South Downs Marathon. First for Marathon Talk was John Cracknell. He says, "After listening to Marathon Talk and my wife and taking on board the pacing advice, set off at a steady pace and stayed patient. Managed to maintain my pace for the distance and gradually gained positions as the race went on. Came in fourth overall in 3:12.35. The whole event was made all the better with great organisation, great marshals, really friendly competitors, and my new wife of 2 months and parents there to watch."
Nice work, crackers.
Great work.
Second was Robert Casserly. Great day. Didn't know what to expect, having not done a trail race. Great support and encouragement, as well as from competitors, as well as spectators. Really needed it when trudging. up some of the steep hills. Respectable 3:37 under your 4-hour target. Well done.
Great running there, Robert. And third, Brian Friend. Brian says, taking a leaf out of Martin's painkiller popping exploits at Comrades.
Oh dear. I must announce at this particular point in the show, I do not condone the popping of painkillers during running.
I think actually we have had, going to a side for a second, we have had a few questions for a training talk on that, and we'll try and find someone who's qualified to give good advice on painkiller popping exploits, and we'll get them on the show as soon as possible. So watch this space. Brian also says, at miles 14 and 19, I took a cocktail of 3 ibuprofen, a sachet of salt, and a gel, and washed them all down with water. I was soon running pain-free again, and with the fairies probably, and able to push on right through to finish in 3:41:52, lopping 13 minutes off my PB for the course.
First woman was Kirsty Reed. A few of the hills were pretty tough, but it was all worth it for the amazing views. Met some really cool people and overheard someone raving about how Martin Liz's coaching had helped him smash his PB at London. Nice one.
Nice. Finishing at 4:02 with a sore hip but happy face.
This week, I had a WFA CFWP on the canal towpath. That's a wife, fisherman and cyclist four-way pass. Yeah, I was running in the same direction as my wife, Ruth, who was doing a threshold run, having decided to come out of marathon retirement and aim for a race in the autumn. The cyclist was heading towards us, and we passed the fisherman, who was static, with a copy of the Daily Star and a half-eat of Morrison's pasty. On the same run, we also came across canoeists and walkers. That's 5 different sports sharing the same playing field. What's that? Walking's not a sport? Well, it is according to most of the surveys into the UK's most popular participation sports. Let's just clarify this. We're not talking about race walking like they do in the Olympics, where you wear a baseball cap and chew a toffee with your bum. Or doing a marathon with a run-walk strategy. No, that's a sport, all right. Oh, no doubt about that. But just walking, going for a walk, how can that be Britain's most popular sport? Form of exercise, maybe, yeah. But sport? I mean, I was always led to believe it was fishing. You know, whenever it's discussed on the radio or the telly, they always say it. Well, of course, fishing is the UK's most popular participation sport. Oh, yeah. Because wherever you go, you can't move for fishermen, can you? Thousands of them, on the folding chairs, drinking out of flasks, avoiding the dentist. Maybe one time in the 1960s, maybe it was the most popular pastime for a short while. But sport? You just sat there most of the time. The only exercise you get is when you flick your wrist. I can think of better ways of doing that. The only reason people believe it's the most popular sport is because fishermen keep saying it. It's like that saying, you're never more than 6 feet away from a rat. Yes, you are. Lots of times. Fishermen, yeah. I mean, they're never more than 6 feet away from a rat. On the canal bank, by a river, on a boat. They just keep banging on about stuff till everyone believes it. I wouldn't be surprised if it was a fisherman who first said muscle turns into fat. In one survey, walking was the most popular sport and swimming was second. Now, swimming has an advantage over other sports because apart from the open water lot, you have to go to a pool to do it, and they can keep tabs on how many people swim. It's relatively easy to quantify. Third in the survey, keep fit yoga, including aerobics and dance exercise. Again, unless you're doing it in your front room with Jane Fonda and Bon Jovi, you go into a gym or sports centre to participate, so they've got the numbers. Not sure if Zumba, boxer size and step are sports either, but fourth place, cycling, yeah. Although how many of those are biking to work or to the shops? Does that count? Fifth place, Q sports. Now, come on, that's a load of billiards, that. Going down the pub for a game of pool, sport. There are loads of these surveys out there. You can see them on the internet. You can chuck in football, badminton, ping pong, golf, horse riding. But come on, what about running? Yeah. Athletics makes it into some of them. But how many pole vaulters and discus throwers do you see out on the pavements every day of the week? Marathon Talk listener Mike Gray posted on Facebook this week, what's the difference between a jogger and a runner? It's not a joke, by the way. Well, if it is, the punchline's terrible. What's the difference between a jogger and a runner? A race entry form. Brilliant. I love it. And that's the truth. Runners race. We compete in our sport. Not only that, but in distance races the world over, we have the opportunity to be in direct competition with the world's best. We run everywhere. In the gyms, by the side of waterways, on the hills, in the parks, on the streets. So, the next time anyone talks to you about our sport, just chuck this into the conversation. Did you know that running is now the world's most popular participation sport? And keep on saying it, loud and proud. It won't take long before everybody believes it. The fishermen have been doing it for years.
Tony's Trials. This week's rant is a rather angry rant, and it comes from Barry Lynch. And Barry says, picture the scene. I've passed the 12-mile mark of the recent Loch Leven half marathon. I'm feeling terrible. I'm running against doctor's advice, taking two separate antibiotics. This is turning into the Drug Takers Anonymous, this show, isn't it? Taking two separate antibiotics for a throat and an ear infection. The reason I had zipped my man suit up was to endure an average heart rate of 185 was to win a bet that I could finish in under 1 hour 50. The slim possibility of matching this time disappeared on a steep hill around mile 8. In fact, my watch is telling me that I've slowed alarmingly and I am now struggling to break 2 hours. Every step is agony. This is particularly muscular pain, but also due to blisters over both feet. The man who has now won our bet is waiting at the finish line with, I imagine, a huge grin for company. What could possibly add to my despair in this personal running nadir? Of course, a succession of smug runners who, having already completed the race, have decided to jog back along the route to emphasise how long it is since they finished the race. They don't actually have a neon sign saying, look at me, I have finished the race, because I still have my race number on, and I am sporting a finisher's hat. I am now warming down slowly, and I am blanking the inferior runners still on the course, because I am so professional. Yes, I could warm down anywhere, but I am choosing to infuriate those runners who cannot keep up with my amazing pace. My pain is long over, but you've got plenty to look forward to. But they might as well have.
That would be one heck of a long sign.
That would be quite some sign, wouldn't it? In fact, they probably wouldn't have run so quick had they been carrying that sign. Anyway, Barry goes on to say, they don't even have the decency to pretend their motivation is encouraging back of the packers like me, as they're not even making eye contact with anyone, let alone actually clapping or cheering. Now, Barry did actually go on to threaten physical violence against these runners. But seeing as this is a family show, we thought we'd leave it there. But thanks for your rave, Barry, and we hope you feel much better for getting that off your chest.
Our rave this week comes from Jamie Stansfield, and Jamie's raving about offices and workplaces, believe it or not. He says, I run into work or I run with my work's running club, and my rave this week is employers that have a run group at lunchtime and that provide showers for when you get back to the office so you don't have to sit smelly at your desk. Brilliant. We love that, Jamie, having the opportunity to go for a run and employers that support you by providing the facility and the opportunity for you to do your health and fitness stuff's awesome. So thanks for sending in your rave.
This week's guest is British-born but resides in the USA. Starting out as an elite swimmer, he narrowly missed making the British Olympic team in both 1992 and 1996, reaching the finals of the Olympic trials in breaststroke and 400 IM. A career as a pro triathlete followed, but was cut short due to overtraining and the resulting chronic fatigue. Combining a wealth of experience with elite endurance sport and a master's degree in clinical and exercise physiology, he now runs his own coaching and performance consultancy company, Purple Patch Fitness, where he works with a host of the world's best Ironman athletes, including Chris Lieto, Rachel Joyce and Sam McGlone. He has also been credited with the key changes to Ryan Hall's training that resulted in the fastest marathon time ever run by a non-African runner, 2:04:58, at this year's Boston Marathon. Welcome to the show, Matt Dixon.
Thanks so much, Tom. Happy to be here.
Matt, it's great to have you here. Now, first of all, when Ryan Hall ran his 2:04:58 and then you were credited with helping him and all kinds of stuff, and someone suggested we speak to you, I was expecting to be speaking to an American. And lo and behold, you're a Brit. Tell us about your origins. Where are you from?
I'm originally, I was born and raised in a little town just outside of Southend-on-Sea in Essex. And so just to the east of London, about 35 miles to the east of London. And grew up there, very typical sort of suburban life. And that's where I actually got into swimming. And And came to the States when I was 18 years of age on a swimming scholarship. So I've actually been living in the States now longer than I have been in England, while I very much remain English, of course. So yeah, I did grow up in England.
And you've kept the accent, which is fantastic, I'm pleased to say. So tell us about your early athletic career. You know, we mentioned in the intro that you were a swimmer, and you've just said then you were a swimming scholarship in America. So, you know, tell us about that.
Well, when I was young and naive, I actually trained in Southend at a swimming club called Rochford, a small club, and went on as an age group athlete and you know, went to nationals and actually in 1992 qualified to the Olympic trials and was happy just to be a participant and ended up reaching the final. And from there, moved on and went to the States and swam at university for the 4 years that you do here, with the goal of coming back and returning to try and make the Olympics in 1996, of which I didn't make. And I think it was the first, that experience, I came over and greatly increased my training in the States. And if I look back on my swimming career now, it was actually one of the first really valuable lessons for me as I moved into coaching, because I would say that I was a world-class trainer and a wonderful trainer, training 27 hours a week in the pool, let alone everything else that we were doing outside on dry land in the weight room. And I could train with anyone, and I think that I left many of my best performances in the swimming pool, in the training swimming pool, rather than actually being able to step up into competition. And so that was the first experience where I realized that perhaps the way that we go about endurance sports is a little excessive to really find true performance.
We see that particularly, I think, with children in this country. I've got a number of friends with kids who are getting into swimming, and they're having to, at the age of, I don't know, 8 or 9, are doing 10 swim sessions a week, and kind of going slightly off tangent, running and triathlon and all that kind of stuff. You know, I always think that's a kind of a crazy amount of training for kids so young. What are your thoughts on that?
I tend to agree, and especially with the very young children. I mean, there's no doubt that swimming is a very technical sport, of course, and you can't replace the early years of swimming, but pushing children, very young children, to 10 or 12 practices or training sessions a week, it makes it very hard for continual progression. And I think most swimmers end up, quote, retiring by the time they're in England, by the time they're 18, many of them, as they go off to university, or when they're 22 in the States, when they finish their collegiate career. And for me, in endurance sports in that age, you haven't even started reaching your prime yet, by any stretch of the imagination, and yet you're so burnt out. I think if you over here, especially if you look at many of the American swimmers, they never want to get into a pool ever again, and that's a crying shame for what is a wonderful sport.
Yeah, it seems from the athletes I've met, it seems swimmers and pools are similar to rowers and concept twos. You can never get either back on the one. I think years of suffering on whatever it was has kind of scarred them for life. And you moved from swimming to triathlon, and then had the opportunity to train for three sports at the same time. So how did that go?
It was wonderful. I managed to take my my world-class training in swimming and progressed it to a much longer sport, half Ironman and half and Ironman racing, and combine it with, you know, obviously with three sports. So I took my excessive training outlook and extended it into triathlon. So I would say that I'm the classic example of how to do a professional triathlon career wrong. And that was despite the fact of my coaching experience with some very, very good age group swimmers after my own swimming career, and also my master's degree in exercise physiology. So having should have known better, I went on and competed as a professional triathlete. And after a very promising first couple of years, I think I trained myself into the ground, both emotionally but physiologically as well. So not the smartest approach, I would say.
Looking back on your triathlon career, what was maybe the kind of the standout highlight performance for you? You know, what did you look back on and go, wow, you know, that was great?
Ironically, it was very, very early in my career, and I think it was the races that I had when I really first got into the sport, and at a time that I wasn't doing so many hours of training. as an amateur athlete coming and winning sort of multiple half Ironman races and then the Los Angeles Triathlon, really just with that sense of youthful naivety and running some of the best running performances that I ever ran. And as I trained more and more and more and got fitter and fitter but more fatigued, I performed less and less. In my professional career, there's a race out here called Vineman, which I managed to win. And that was probably my biggest accomplishment. But by the time I was really progressing and maturing emotionally in the sport, I think physically I was already declining. So I don't look back at my athletic performances in triathlon with too much satisfaction, I would say.
Reading about the stuff you've done and looking at the videos you've been in, there's some great stuff. I do urge people to go to your website. There's some really, really great stuff on there, which we'll get into in a bit. It seems that your coaching philosophy is grounded massively in your own athletic experiences, and it's around optimizing health, integrating recovery and working on nutrition and that kind of stuff.
It is. I mean, certainly a large part of it is my own experience, but I would also say that it's grounded in observation as well, and my coaching experiences that I've gone through, both as a swimming coach and then moving on as a triathlon coach and working with a wide range of athletes. And I think that the methodology that we use, or the philosophy, the set of beliefs that underpins all of our coaching at Purple Patch has evolved and is continuing to evolve at all times, which I think any smart sort of coaching philosophy should. But yeah, going through my own experiences of chronic fatigue, and it was perhaps the most vital thing, the defining moment, I would say, because what that forced me to do was take a step back and not only look at my own performance and my own training methodology, but also look at endurance sports as a whole and look at the way that many people were preparing for them and really see that so many people were training very, very hard, were highly motivated, and yet weren't getting the return on their training investment. And I felt that many athletes were going into races and major events very, very fit but fatigued. And it started to sort of allow me to shift my lens away from, well, this is the classic way of training, and shifting more to, surely there's a more logical way to approach training that can still facilitate performances, but allow people to stay healthy.
That point, I was thinking a lot about this before speaking to you, and I was thinking, well, we get an awful lot of questions about overtraining, what's too much, how do you recognise it, and so on. And I was thinking that up to a point, more hours is better. So if you train for 1 hour a week compared to someone who trains 5 hours a week, it's likely that the person training 5 hours a week is going to do better. Maybe 10 hours a week is going to be better. And the point is probably different for every person, but there comes a point where more no longer equals more, more equals less. But it's very difficult as an athlete to decide what that point is. Do you have any advice for people who are thinking, well, should I do, what sort of things should they look out for that kind of typify overtraining? In fact, you said in the bit you wrote about working with Ryan, you said that when you first spoke, it was clear that he'd lost some of his emotional edge and his direction relating to marathon performance. How do you recognise those kind of things?
You know, unfortunately, it's not a cake recipe where you just put the pieces and say, aha, here he is. There's obviously some physiological markers that you could look at in blood work, specifically for when the body is not operating at the top level. But that being said, the biggest markers come through almost self-assessment and self-interviewing. And, you know, there are all sorts of very, very common traits and signs that I look for in athletes that I would say are red flags. When people start to have continual declining performance in training, so they're training harder and harder but they're not improving, well, that's a question to look at your training. But more than that, it's very, very basic stuff, but are people enjoying the training, or is the enthusiasm going down? Are they having consistent sleep? And I think that broken sleep and broken quality of sleep, you often hear athletes talking about night sweats. Well, night sweats are not a good thing. And yet people ignore those warning signs, things like that, changes of appetite. There are many, many markers that can indicate, the body's inability to respond to the training. We actually use a tool which I think is actually quite a new tool, but it's a fantastic tool to actually monitor fatigue, and it's by a company called Restwise. And it's very interesting because it takes a series of objective data points as well as some subjective data points, mood, enthusiasm, performance in the last workout, and they create an algorithm to give you a recovery score. And we actually use that for many of our athletes of all levels. And it gives it a little bit more of an objective data point as to how recovered or ready for training the athlete is. And I find that a very interesting and useful tool to use.
So it actually allows you to say, you know, I don't know what the numbers are, but you are a 5 at the minute or a 6. And if you get above an 8 or whatever it is, that's something that then would flag it up that, hang on a minute, you know, you're potentially moving into an overtrained state.
Yeah, they create a score that's from 0 to 100 with about 80 being normal, and it's a learning algorithm, so it's actually quite interesting way to approach it, because it's a very personal thing. And when you start to see scores that are dipping into the 60s, rather than it being an absolute, well, that person's not ready to train, what it is it's a great conversation starter. And you say, well, that athlete will probably be better with moving that hard session further on when the body is more able to accept the training that they're going to place on it.
I've always felt that the term overtraining is not quite correct. I've often felt it's more under recovering, or more often in people that are overtrained, it tends to be they haven't recovered well enough. That seems to tie in with a lot of the focus of your stuff. Would you agree with that? And what would your thoughts be on that?
Do you mind if I steal that? I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, feel free.
Absolutely. I think it's absolutely the case. I think the first thing to say is that you have to be very careful. People throw around overtraining a lot. And, I think that many people say, oh, I'm overtrained, or so many people are overtrained. It's very hard to truly get overtrained to a state of complete fatigue. But your point of people under recovering, I think that that's a great way, or a great lens to look through, because when I look at many athletes, endurance athletes, and this is from professional level all the way down to fitness enthusiasts, it's true that in order for us to improve, we have to train hard. So the point of recovery or a lack of recovery or overtraining is not due to, it's not to say that you're not training enough. So you have to train hard to improve. That's a given.
Yeah.
We all have to train hard. The question is, any good training program that is built correctly will include enough recovery to enable you to create the adaptations that you want to from that training. So often people, I think that most athletes logically understand, cognitively understand the importance of recovery. Not many do it. And that extends all the way through. So under recovery, I think, is the biggest problem, and it's the thing that creates the biggest physiological and fatigue issues that we see in our sports.
In Ryan Hall talking about the stuff that you guys did before Boston, he says that Matt had an original view of recovery that was a little bit outside of the box in terms of what most elite runners in the US are told, and that appealed to me. So what is that for a runner? I mean, I read Ryan Hall's great book, Running with Joy, which I think was the build-up to last year's Boston, I think it was. And it's got all his training laid out, a really great honest appraisal of all his training. And how do you work with, what is your original kind of outside of the box view of recovery? Because it's not just, right, we're going to cut 5-year sessions and that's it. I imagine it's a little more complicated than that.
It is. it is more complicated, but also it's actually very simple. Much of it comes from the way that you approach building training programs. And I always talk about the pillars of performance. At Purple Patch, we have four pillars that make up any endurance sport's route to performance. And it originates with the fundamental belief that, yes, you have to train hard in order for you to improve your performance. But the question for me has always been, what is the thing that facilitates the maximal adaptations from the hard training that all athletes are willing to put in, at least all motivated athletes are willing to put in? What's the thing that facilitates the maximal gains? And I think that your body cannot accept the training or facilitate maximal gains unless it's healthy. And by healthy, I don't mean just an absence of disease. I mean metabolically healthy, having a strong immune system, a balanced hormonal profile, and of course, an absence of disease. And when I look at most athletes, they train to a point that their metabolic health becomes suppressed. So to try and avoid that, when we set up a training program, in Ryan Hall's case, we set up a training program, and the core focus for most athletes is the endurance training part, the actual running that he was doing. And that's very, very important, of course. In fact, it's critical. He's a runner, and the running is a massive component of it. But for us, the lens or the set of beliefs that we look through is the running is only as important as the three other pillars of his performance. There's the running training or the endurance component, and then the three other pillars are nutrition, recovery, and functional strength. And so in Ryan's case, or actually really in anybody's case, the recovery becomes as much of a critical component of the overall plan as does the training. Now, as simple as that is, it's pretty different than I find most athletes go about it. The first question that I always get is, how many hours do I have to do to get ready for an Ironman? Or how many hours do I have to run to get ready for a marathon? And it's very difficult to answer that question because it really depends on the athlete's background, the other stresses that the athlete has in their life, whether it's work, family, relationships, and how much training that they can absorb. So we try and create training programs that can be integrated into the athlete's life and can be balanced with enough recovery to facilitate, number one, health, and therefore, number two, performance that arrives from that hard work.
In terms of that health, I feel like, certainly looking back at my Ironman, I call it a career, I mean, I was never a professional athlete, but my Ironman career, I feel like there were times when, as the athlete, you become kind of numbed to the health and the fatigue feelings. You actually, it's not even like you're in denial of, oh no, I'm fine. Actually, you don't really notice it because it becomes that feeling of tiredness and fatigue becomes the norm. It's quite difficult to actually recognize those signs, isn't it?
It is, and it's and not only that, the many athletes believe and are told to believe that massive fatigue and a loss of a word that I like, vibrancy, a loss of vibrancy is the norm. And that's just something that you have to push through. Preparing for an Ironman triathlon is tough. It takes a lot of commitment. It takes a lot of training. And you will get tired during the course of that training. But the numbness or the emotional fatigue and physical fatigue that originates from many training programs leaves people, I think, very fit but tired. And I don't think that you ever have to get to that place. And you know, ultimately, performance originates from hard work and optimal health. And if you can have an athlete that is vibrant as well as very, very fit, on any single day, the Ironman performance day, it becomes much more reasonable to go and do something pretty special. And that's what we're finding with many of our athletes right now.
And there's a couple of things that Ryan Hall suggested. Obviously, he'd done that. He said that, well, there were three things, really. He said that he did less volume on his easy days. He had more recovery days between his workouts. And the distance of his intervals got shorter. Now, we'll put the speed thing to a side for the minute if we're talking about the distance of the intervals. But he says, you know, more recovery days between workouts and less volume on the easy days. Could you give us some details on that kind of stuff, some specifics?
Specifically with Ryan, he was a very interesting case because when I looked at Ryan's training program, I think it's important to point out Ryan had wonderful coaches before I helped him. And when I looked at Ryan's training program, there was nothing specifically, if you looked at the key workouts, there was nothing in there that I thought, well, I wouldn't do that. I thought all the workouts and his general approach was very, very good. So it was just obvious to me that he had got overtired and wasn't operating in a place of vibrancy. So the solution was pretty simple. I think that Ryan has great natural speed for an athlete, and it seemed to me like he'd lost that natural vibrancy and that natural speed. So what we tried to do is try to highlight or maximize the importance of the key sessions and then allow him to have more recovery between by linking together the extended easier days, and then cut out some of the, I would say, low baggage workouts that he had on his very light days. So he was sometimes running two or three times during an easy day, and I felt like he could drop that down, and rather than going on an easy 60-minute run, he could go on an easy or 30 or 40-minute run, very, very light, and then substitute the evening run with either aqua jogging, so something that was less pounding on the body, or just having it off and focusing more on rest and recovery. You know, one thing that we knew with Ryan is fitness was not his limiter. He was a professional runner. He was very, very fit. So that wasn't the reason that he was dropping off at the end of races. So our goal was, number one, maintain his great fitness, but then bring up his vibrancy and his health so that he could actually, on any given day, maximize his performance. And that was sort of the underpinning philosophy.
You know, you talk there about reducing kind of the length of some of the runs or taking them out. How, we hear the term junk mileage all the time. How do you, but then we see all kinds of elite runners and successful runners doing lots of runs where they just kind of go out and run, whether it's 5 miles every morning and then another run in the evening, whatever it is. Is it possible even to define what a junk mile is? Like, if I, you know, if one of our listeners was to look at their program, is there a way they can say, well, that mile's a junk mile, but that mile isn't? I don't even know if that's possible.
Well, I think that the magic word in training is the specificity, and I think it's absolutely critical that any athlete of any level understands why they're doing something. And I don't think there's a magic recipe for every runner to follow. So to answer your question sort of in a broad way, every athlete has their own recipe of what works for them. And some athletes respond to more miles of running at a lower intensity. Other athletes require high intensity and much less miles to get to their best performance. So the first thing I'd say is you have to understand and find out what works for you. That being said, I find that many athletes add in running miles without really understanding why they're adding in miles. So they just go out and run. And I think it's the pursuit. Some of that is insecurity. So most people are worried if they're getting ready for an Ironman or if they're getting ready for a marathon. Can I complete the distance? Will I die? And so they fear that fitness is the limiter and the muscular resilience that occurs with it. So they just add running in for the sake of running in with the hope that they'll get fitter. When you look at your program, if any runner looks at their program, they should have a clear understanding of the specific goal of every single run. And one of the specific goals might be a very easy run that's built around recovery or just perhaps building around muscular resilience. But make sure that you understand that that's the purpose of the run, and then it's not a junk mile. But just adding in frivolous miles for the sake of it, adding in miles, by definition, that becomes junk in my mind.
So you might say, for example, that, I don't know, you have a hard session on a Tuesday night, and you know that if you can get out for half an hour or something on a Wednesday morning, that helps to loosen your legs, clear some waste products out, and makes you feel a little bit better. So that would be a good run to do. But you might know that if that, and adding another 3 miles to that wouldn't improve that effect at all. You'd feel just as good after three as you do after six. So the extra three would be, in inverted commas, junk miles.
Absolutely. And the question that the, you know, that you should ask yourself is, well, why would I add the extra three? And if the answer is, well, maybe I can get a bit fitter for it. And then by definition, the goal of that session has changed and it's the wrong goal.
Of course, because that's not a session that's trying to get, that's not the purpose of that session. That session is about making you feel better. Fantastic. That's really helped, actually. Now, nutrition is obviously a huge, huge part of all of this. And in reading around the stuff you do, you talk a lot about athletes feeling the need to be light at the cost of everything and not eating enough. You talk also, you had a great quote. You said you're amazed at the endurance athletes who proclaim they can run miles and miles on a sip of water or a sniff of gel. Of course they can, but not many realize the cumulative impact it has on recovery and effective, consistent training. Now, many of us as endurance athletes veer from 1 minute we're training and we're hardly eating anything and we're getting really, really light. We're maybe performing well, but perhaps we're not eating the healthiest of diet. Then we stop training and we eat McDonald's for breakfast, lunch and dinner. I'm sure there's a happy medium in there somewhere, but of course none of us want that. I don't like the term everything in moderation because I don't want to be a moderate runner, as it were. So how do you get around that with athletes? What are your, I mean, this is a hugely broad question worth hours of an answer probably, but what's your views on nutrition, Matt?
The first thing I'd say is, I just wrote an article on nutrition actually that will be coming out, and I included two quotes to start that I realised I was saying at a seminar last week, and the first was, the vast majority of athletes that I work with that are looking to improve body composition, that are endurance athletes, I have to get them to exercise less and eat more. And the second quote was, I've yet to meet an athlete of any level that eats enough to support the training that they do. So I think that one of the biggest issues for endurance athletes, and this certainly applies to runners and absolutely to triathletes as well, I have yet to meet an athlete that eats enough or supports their training with enough nutrition. And so I think it's a massive problem in endurance sports. And I think actually... is one of the areas that can help facilitate unlocking further levels of performance for all levels of athletes. The way that I look at it, I think that nutrition has to be divided into two areas, because these two areas have vastly different needs and roles with what's required to approach them, and that's your nutrition. Those are the calories that you eat in daily life, breakfast, lunch and dinners and your other small meals. And then your fueling, which are the calories that you take in during and immediately following exercise. In my experience, the fueling component, those calories that athletes take in during and immediately following exercise, is the biggest weakness for most endurance athletes. In fact, if we go back to Ryan Hall, that was one of his weaknesses. He was eating a very healthy diet. His nutrition was good, although probably not quite enough calories until we met each other. But how he was fueling, he was under fueling and therefore not supporting the training. And so I would urge... The first thing that I look at when I help endurance athletes is to look at the fueling first, because that is the gateway to facilitate good nutrition. And I think it's really important to understand that fueling properly, taking in enough calories during and immediately following exercise, there are four reasons for that. And the first reason is the only one that people actually think about, which is the performance during the workout. Can I get through the workout? And that's actually pretty easy, especially for most runners. You can get through most sessions without taking in many or any calories. But that's only one reason that fueling is important. it's massively important what you do during and following activity to facilitate and maximize recovery. It also has massive, the third reason is that it has massive implications in how you, the type of food choices that you make later in the day. And underfueling will have all sorts of negative consequences for how you eat later in the day. And then the final reason is training in itself is a massive physiological stress, but athletically starving yourself during and following that workout is another additional stress that will suppress your metabolic health. And having proper fueling will help support and offset some of the physiological stress of the training stimulus. And so we actually really encourage athletes to fuel properly so that they can support metabolic health and try and offset some of the stress that suppresses the system.
I mean, we have a lot of runners that will get up early in the morning, no breakfast, and they'll go out on a long run without having anything on the run. They might not even, they might not even rush to eat something that quickly afterwards. And they'd say, yeah, but I'm still doing my long run, it's still fine, I'm fine. And you'd argue that actually there's a deeper level of damage being done by that.
Certainly a deeper level of damage being done. And, it's the classic, I can ride to Belgium on an apple and a flask of water. Yes, you can, but is it the best way to do it? When you wake up in the morning, there isn't too much wrong with getting up in the morning and starting your run without a full breakfast. I understand that it's very, very hard to have a full breakfast right before a run. But I think that it is critically important to fuel during that run to support it. But most importantly, immediately following that run is probably the most critical time to eat of any session in the day. It's actually funny, as a tip that I saw, Ryan, this is one of the major things that we changed with Ryan's approach to his training. And he said to me after Boston, I probably fuel 10 times more than any other US runner. And there's only one type of runner that I've met that fuels more than me, and that's the Kenyans. And I thought that was quite an interesting comment.
Wow, very interesting. Very interesting.
The amount of calories that it takes to support consistent endurance activity is very, very large. And the fueling is a component of it to try and offset much of the deficit that you create.
Is there a good, because obviously we want people to maintain a good athletic physique for their performance. It's easy to eat too little and it's easy to eat too much. It's quite difficult to eat the correct amount, of course. Is there an easy way to understand? I'm not myself a total believer in counting calories, and I think it's very difficult to count both calories in and out. Do you have any advice for people as to how they might work out what the right amount to eat for them would be?
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with you. In fact, I seldom to never have athletes count calories because I think that it can be more simple for that unless there's something medical going on that you're forced to. But for the most part, healthy eating habits occur, and this is specific to athletic populations, endurance athletes. In my experience, I found that if the athlete is very good at wrapping their workouts in carbohydrates, to make it simple, in other words, ingesting mostly carbohydrate during training sessions and then following the workout with plenty of carbohydrate. And my goal, philosophically, in reality, we never get there, but philosophically, trying to within 60 to 90 minutes following any exercise session, offset any deficit that we've created through caloric burn with mostly carbohydrates and some protein following workout. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But in other words, really try and load up the caloric intake immediately following any exercise session, any training session that we do. If we compartmentalize that, and then outside, if that is successful, and if we do that, and eat plenty then, and I'll come back to what plenty is in a second, for the rest of the day, outside of that, assuming that they're not exercising again, their focus should be frequent meals that are focused mostly around a few things, which are the building blocks, your proteins, plenty of, I was going to say vitamins and minerals, but as it's English, I'll say vitamins and minerals. So that's, where do you get those? You get those from your vegetables and fruits, and then some plenty of good oils as well. And if people really do a great job of wrapping their workouts in carbohydrates, they can have less of a focus on starchy carbohydrates in the rest of the day, but plenty of proteins, good oils, and plenty of fruits and vegetables. We always have the philosophy, it's impossible to put on weight during and immediately following exercise. So that's a time, during and immediately following exercise is a time to have, don't limit yourself whatsoever with how many calories you take in there, is a good rule of thumb. But in the rest of the day, if you then shift your focus to lean meats and vegetables and eating frequently, it tends to be self-controlling. Obviously, a healthy diet is absolutely critical for athletic performance, and that, I think that's the easiest route to get there.
Now, I can't let you go without talking about speed. Reinhold's talked a lot about running fast to do well in his marathons, and he's obviously said that he's done short intervals, and there was a real focus on speed. He also did the American US 1 mile champs the other day, went off, I think he went through, what was it, four quarter mile in 61 or something, and I think he might have crashed and burned towards the end, but it was a heroic attempt, and I know he wants to go sub four for the mile. How do you incorporate speed? Do you think people underestimate the importance of speed within marathon training, and how would you recommend people bring that into their training?
You like to ask me the big questions, don't you?
Sorry.
in short, yes, they do undervalue the value of speed, but speed for me, when I talk about speed, when people talk about speed, the most important thing for marathon performance is specific marathon training. And training the body at or just above an intensity of which the goal is to go to. So if somebody is looking to run a marathon at 4:45 pace or quicker than that, they have to do plenty of training at or above that pace. And that's in stark contrast with many training programs that if somebody's looking to run a 3-hour marathon and they feel like their most important session of the week is to go out and run 3 hours, but they do that at a pace significantly slower than what it is to do a 3-hour marathon, let's call it 7-minute mile pace, how are you ever going to go faster than that on race day? So for me, when it relates to marathon, there are two types of, quote, speed work. There's your specific endurance, which is the most important thing, which isn't truly speed work. That being said, I think that there's an over-reliance on pure volume. And I like athletes, whether it's marathon, whether it's Ironman athletes, I like athletes to have a range of gears and a full capacity to have the ability to perform at every intensity. And so we incorporate speed of some nature into every single week of every session of the whole season. Now, how much of that it occurs depends on the phase of the time of the year or the background of the athlete. How do you incorporate it into the week? I think that you have to be very careful with how many times your body goes up to a high intensity, once or twice a week at the very most. But I would say that the speed training for the majority of recreational or amateur, serious amateur athletes is the biggest limiter for most athletes, I would say.
So a lack of speed training.
Lack of speed training, yeah.
So, Ryan said 400 meter repeats were kind of key in some of his interval training. And what would that be, 10 or 12 400s or 6 or 8? Or how many, and what sort of recovery?
There are two types. There are... So in Ryan's specific case, Ryan came from Ryan's natural weapon as a marathon runner is his speed. Originally, if you look at him historically, he has great potential relative to other marathon runners. He had the capacity, and he had lost that speed. He had a very small range of speeds that he could run at, and if he went to run a 1 mile race, he wouldn't run very well. He didn't have the capacity to run even a 5K race. So our focus with Ryan was he had this massive, massive base of fitness, and we wanted to teach him to sort of refine his weapon that was his pure natural speed. So he was doing repetitions of 400s with a lot more rest. And, you know, let's say it was something like 6-800s with 2 to 3 minutes rest, but actually holding a pace that was much, much faster than his goal marathon pace to be able to do that. But what we would also include for him is he would get ready for his next marathon, we would include something like 400s can be included on the track, where it might be specific into his marathon training preparation. And this is a great workout to do for any athlete that's getting ready for a marathon, where you do an endurance piece, whether it's 60 or 75 minutes or 90 minutes, where you're focusing on steady, smooth endurance effort, and then finishing with 15, 20, 25, even 30 times 400 with only 30 seconds rest. But you're doing those 400s at a pace that is just a little bit quicker than your goal marathon pace. Is that true speed work? No, I wouldn't say it's true speed work, but it's very, very specific to the marathon. And it's tuning the body to run faster than your marathon pace.
I'm conscious of time. I don't want to keep you all day. I'm so grateful of you giving us all your time. So final question, Matt. We ask this to all our interviewees, and in fact we've obviously asked this to Ryan himself as well. If we gave you 6 months of absolute perfect training, and we guaranteed you weren't going to get injured or ill, you were going to get to the start of this event feeling vibrant, what do you think you could run a mile in?
Myself?
Yeah, yourself. What could you run 1 mile in? We now have 61 people on this list, from Sister Madonna Buddha right through to Ben Limo at the front with 3:49. Ryan's in third place with 3:55. He reckoned he could do for a mile, although I had to tease it out of him a little bit. What do you think you could do?
What did Ryan say, 3:55?
3:55.
I'll say 3:54. I'm afraid I'm not so... Well, as I'm a diesel engine that's weighing in around 200 pounds and... a bit more like a tank rather than a Porsche sports car. I would guess 6 months pure training, no injury, no sickness. My guess is that I could run somewhere around a 4:45.
Okay, that puts you neck and neck with Scott Jurek and Liz McColgan, 2 seconds ahead of Catherine Deraba, 5 seconds behind Liz Yelling. So you're in some great company in there. 4:45 it is.
I'm going to get a little stick for this one.
Matt, you're an absolute star. We really appreciate your time. It's been fascinating speaking to you, and good luck to you and all your athletes for the rest of the season and beyond.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. I very much enjoyed being on. Cheers.
This week's winner of the week is slightly unusual in that he's been nominated by Tom and I. In fact, he's pretty unusual in other ways as well. Anyway, when we started the show back in January 2010, he contacted us and offered to create some audio content for each episode, completely for free. And despite being one of the busiest people we know, he's since produced 63 episodes of Tony's Trials and several special editions. He's created terms like having a gingerbread man that have become fixed in a runner's language, and he's become a huge part of the Marathon Talk community, helping us reach the 500,000 download mark. Last Wednesday, a computer failure meant he had to re-record the entire thing. Despite not getting home from work after a really tough day till 9 p.m, he reloaded all the correct software and started again from scratch, delivering Tony's Trials in time for us to get the show out by midnight. Without doubt, a real winner. This week's winner of the week is the legendary Tony Aldenshaw.
Okay, it is time to close. Don't forget to rate your run on marathontalk.com, and that opens at midnight every Saturday. The first one to post will always get their, well, depending on what they post, but they should always get their rating posted. Don't forget to pop along to our events pages on Facebook site and let us know what you're up to. Remember to add yourself to the events you're attending and let us know if you'd like us to add an event. Now, both of those things, well, Rate Your Run is already on marathontalk.com, but we're looking to bring the events onto marathontalk.com, and I don't think that's far away. So those of you that don't like to use Facebook will be able to use it on marathontalk.com, and it'll become a lot easier. But add your own races and everything, so it should be fantastic. Watch this space on that kit. We're also hoping to have some technical running gear news probably by next week's show. I think by next week's show. So fingers crossed, watch this space, and we should have a really, really exciting announcement next week. Now, Mark, what are you up to?
Well, firstly, I think I better remind everyone that it's Father's Day here in the UK on Sunday, June the 19th. Don't forget that. Tom, it will be your last Father's Day without being a dad.
I know. How's that amazing? I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. There you go.
Can I buy myself a present anyway?
You can wait till next year. I'm going to get out on my mountain bike again. I'm really enjoying getting back into that. So I'm going to try and get out on the mountain bike at the weekend. And I promise myself that I will get this MRI sorted on my niggling knee so I can get back out running on the roads.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hope they do fix that, mate. I hope it was not too long a wait. The MRI scans can be a pain. Anyway, I'm off to Durham to look. That's later today, in fact. So the show should be out early this week because I need to get on the train at 4 o'clock. So I'm off to Durham to look at a new park run course this evening. Watch this space for some exciting announcements through there. This weekend, it's the Kitzbühel ITU race. Now, Jan Frodeno, Javier Gomez and Johnny Brownlee, none of those on the start list, I don't think. Alistair is doing it. However, excitingly, Chris McCormack, World Ironman champion, is also doing it. Now, that could be really quite exciting. All the hype is Alistair versus Chris McCormack. I don't think that'll be the case. I think it'll be Chris McCormack trying to hang on to the back of the swim, but we'll see.
Well, he does come from an ITU background.
Yeah,
he's
been world ITU champion, I think, in the past, in fact. Yeah. And, you know, he's undoubtedly one of the greatest triathletes of all time. I'm a massive Macca fan. However, I think this will probably be a step too far, so close to having just won Challenge Cairns, I think, in a rather fast Ironman time. I'm also obviously preparing for this exciting meeting we've got about technical gear and other stuff, popping down to Poole next week. So next week we'll be recording the show together, mate, which we don't often do.
No, I'm really looking forward to that.
It should be really good. So tune in next week for, wow, next week's going to be amazing, isn't it? We've got Mo Farah. We've hopefully got some really exciting announcements about other stuff. It's going to be a really, really, really great show. So other than that, it's now time for the Marathon Talk Listener Launchpad, where over the next 4 weeks, we list the marathons where you guys are running. And remember, if your marathon's not on here, drop us an email, info@marathontalkers.com, and let us know, and let's get it on the launch pad. This week, June the 18th, the Grand Miles Marathon USA, the Portumna Forest Marathon in Ireland, the West Highland Way, which is 95 miles in Scotland, and on Sunday, June the 19th, the Perth Marathon in Australia, and the Wellington Marathon in New Zealand. Wow, we've got listeners running this weekend in USA, Ireland, Scotland, Australia and New Zealand. Fantastic.
Nice. It's 1 week until the Jack and Jill Downland Ultra. And then on June the 25th, it's the Holly Challenge, the Malvern Midsummer Marathon, the Sundown 100K Ultra, the Midnight Sun Marathon in Tromso and the Rock and Roll Seattle Marathon. Then on Sunday the 26th, it's the North Devon Marathon, the Mont Blanc Marathon, the Mount Kilimanjaro Marathon, the Boddington 50K Marathon and the Pitchy Richie Marathon.
The Pitchy Richie Marathon, that is in southern Australia. And it's 2 weeks until Thursday, June the 30th, for the Lakeland 50, and Sunday, July the 3rd, the Lakeland Trail Marathon and the Gold Coast Marathon. The following 2 weeks, we've only got one marathon in listeners' marathons. Monday, July the 11th, the Al Andalush Ultra Trail, and Sunday, July the 17th, the 50-mile challenge in Kent. And that is it. So check us out on marathontalk.com, pop along to facebook.com/marathontalk, or listen to our tweet at twitter.com/marathontalk. I'm Tom Williams, he's Martin Yelling. Next week we've got Mo Farah, and that was Marathon Talk.